concern some secret findings at the Smithsonian. So, leave you in suspense as to what's so secret at the Smithsonian. Well, our first speaker this morning, again, is one of the people that needs no introduction because he's very familiar to most of you, and this is certainly not the first time he's spoken at ARS conventions. Martin, yes. Martin has produced many, many very important jazz reissues and also other types of reissues besides jazz. One of his albums was mentioned a couple of days ago in one of the sessions, in the session about the Ziegfeld Follies. So we are going to hear from him on one of his latest pet projects of Duke Ellington. Martin Williams.
Thank you. I'll try not to run over my time, but in case I do, I will really miss having Peter Bergman jump up and cut me off.
Yeah,
oh, there you are.
Assign him that job.
Yeah. I really appreciate being able to talk to you about this subject. This is something that some of you, at least two people in the room, I think they're in the room. If they're not, they'll have to answer to me afterward, have heard me talk about before in one version or another. And the more I'm able to do this again in front of different sorts of audiences, the more I hope I improve the presentation. And I should tell you that it comes about because, I'll leave myself out of this. Several of us, most prominently Gunther Schuller, have been making an assertion for almost a decade now that Ellington should be considered the major American composer, regardless of category or style of music. And that's a kind of an alarming proposition to some people and a delightful one to others. And since no musicologists have stepped forward to pick up this challenge and either deal with it or refute it, or I've just said, well, maybe I can try. And what I'm doing here is my idea of follow the same procedure that I might follow if I were to stand up here and defend in front of you or any audience, let's say Brahms is a major composer, how would I go about doing that? And this is my, and I don't know that I've done it right. I mean, I don't know that my method or my approach is correct, but it's the only one I could think of. So that's what I propose to do with Ellington. When he died 10 years ago, of course, he was in most people's minds a dance band leader and a guy who wrote some popular songs that everybody knows, whether they want to or not. It's like, you know, everybody knows some Gershwin, everybody knows some Porter, everybody knows some Ellington. But if we look at his career and his output from a slightly different point of view, we would come up with this kind of description. For one thing, he wrote a huge body of music between 1923 and 1974 when he died. He was certainly a tunesmith. He wrote popular songs. Sometimes he even wrote the lyric himself. And those are songs that everybody knows. He also wrote songs specifically as parts of theater music. He did not have in his lifetime a successful musical piece of musical theater that is successful in terms of Broadway. And that was one thing he always wanted to have. And did not, but some of the songs that were written for shows that flopped, you know, and we all know. He wrote works for solo piano, beginning in about 1928, and he continued to throughout his career, although beginning in about 1940, those usually took the form of duos for piano and bass. He wrote works for small jazz ensemble from 6 to 9 pieces, recorded them usually under the nominal leadership of one of his sidemen. He wrote an enormous number of instrumental miniatures for his orchestra. He wrote long works, extended works, all of them in one or another kind of suite form for the jazz ensemble. He wrote works for symphony orchestra and jazz ensemble combined toward the end of his life. He did movie and television scores, background music for movie and TV, a little bit of one of which you will hear. He wrote toward the end of his life also some liturgical works, which he called sacred concerts. They too are in suite form, and they even included solo for tap dancer. One of them did. He had the very high privilege that Joseph Haydn had of hearing anything he wrote played immediately by his own orchestra. All of his career he had that. His musical associate Billy Strayhorn once said of Ellington, "He plays the piano, but his real instrument is the orchestra." And Ellington worked with his players individually, as the great dramatists of the past worked with their actors, writing and developing musical ideas specifically for their talents, their individual sounds. Indeed, some of the very originality in harmonic thinking, in voicing, that is so remarkable in Ellington comes about not in any abstract that what would it sound like if I put these notes together, but what would it sound like if I put that fellow's G, this guy's F sharp, and the way that guy does a low B flat, put that together. That's how really he arrived at those things. So you might say that he is the jazz composer par excellence because he is writing for the individual, and jazz was and is an individual music. But at the same time, remember, if it is true that great works of choreography, great works of theater, and great works of music were created with specific players and their resources in mind, we still play those works, we still perform those works. So it is possible to do the same with Ellington. The fact that those players are dead or not available to us does not mean we can't play his music. At least that's the hope which is being daily fulfilled, by the way. Let me go directly to some music now. Let's take the cab. You have a handout there. I like Gunther's quote there, in spite of their slight rhetorical redundancy of total uniqueness, which I was mean enough to leave in. Thank you, Phil, for pointing that out. Let's take melody. The three excerpts I am giving you, I pick because I like them, but also because they are unfamiliar. I am deliberately avoiding, until we get to the very end of this, anything that you are likely to know in the ordinary course of just, you know, what you can't avoid knowing because you live in this country and you inevitably have heard a lot of Ellington. So this is an excerpt from a symphony in black. Symphony in Black was originally written as a film. It's not a symphony, of course, it's another suite. And this is the spiritual theme, if you will, from that. And this the single petal of a rose, as you see indicated, was written in a suite written for Elizabeth II. Is it not true that if any other composer in the world had written a piece of music for Elizabeth II, that we would all know about it? Is it not true? Of course we would. Ellington wrote such a piece, commissioned by a relative of the Queen. I beg your pardon? I did not say that. I said, I'm sorry, I implied that and I didn't mean to. What I mean is, we would know about all these pieces. No, okay. And then I picked the third one because it is a secondary theme in a piece which, in simplified form, became one of Ellington's popular song hits. Don't get around much anymore, but this is the most attractive melody in it to me, this thing. Okay, here we go. Sorry about that. My frank opinion is that Ellington was not a great melodist. I do not think, even in the category of popular songwriting, that he was as good a melodist as Gershwin or Arlen, the two that I happen to admire most in respect of melody. But, you know, there have been many great composers who were not great melodists if the standards of melody in European music are set by Mozart and Schubert, let's say, then Beethoven was not a great melodist, and so be it. That doesn't mean I think he was a faulty melodist. My next suggestion about his musicianship has to do specifically with his relationship with the players, and it has to do with his discovery, their discovery, and his use of their discoveries of instrumental techniques. Now, this kind of thing, of course, has been common in jazz since its very beginnings, that is, quote, unorthodox, unquote, instrumental techniques and sounds. It was not too long ago that all of this was still categorically disapproved of by what were then called legitimate musicians, I hope no longer so called. And I think it's worth keeping that in mind. What happened to Paganini when he started doing things with the violin he wasn't supposed to do? Or did one think of it that way? Well, in any case, since the first two of these have to do with brass instruments, specifically cornet and trumpet, maybe a moment's pause there is on that category. Now, I'm not talking about the kind of muted work that you're going to hear here, muted in two senses. That's obvious enough in American music, and the way we have developed and used mutes on brass. What is not so obvious, I think, is a difference not only in the range of the trumpet and its cousins, but also in the working range I'm talking about, top and bottom, by the way, but also in the function of that instrument in people's thinking. I know that jazz players particularly have made that group of instruments, and the trumpet particularly, into carriers of melody in a way that they were not before. In everybody's thinking, all composers and players have been affected by this. There's a viola there, if you will. Again, all this is arguable, but I don't think it's foolishness that I'm proposing here. In any case, what I'm going to show you doesn't directly relate to that. This first one is the technique that Rex Stewart had of getting plaintive sounds out of the cornet with using the half valve. Now, there were only certain tones you can do that with, and Ellington was very resourceful at using those. This is from a live performance of Black, Brown, Beige, as it says there. And that may be, although Ellington was constantly dissatisfied with Black, Brown, Beige, it may really be the best long work he ever did. It was the longest at its, when it premiered. It was far more ambitious than anything he'd done up to that point in the way of extended writing. So this is Rex's Emancipation Celebration. And incidentally, if you know this piece, appropriately enough, this is a musical paraphrase of the spiritual theme, which is called Come Sunday, which is in the first movement of Black, Brown, Beige, or the one that's usually called Black. Okay, here's the valve or the plinger trumpet by the man who developed it more fully to me than any of the other players. Cootie Williams was really named Charles, if anybody cares. And we've got the same passage played two ways with the plunger. The plunger is called a plunger because literally it was the end of the plumber's, the plumber's friend, as you call it, and was put manipulated in front of the horn. It is a finely wrought technique. A lot of people think, this is just so spontaneous and natural, and I mean, the nuances that Cootie could manipulate with this thing are indescribable in their gradations and variety. But you will hear him using it two ways, one in front of the open horn, and the same passage as he did it with the little short straight mute, which we call the pony in jazz. It's a straight mute, but it is short, so it fits fully inside the horn, inside the bell, and manipulating the plunger in front of that. Happily, he recorded the same piece both ways. Now the next one I simply couldn't resist. I could go on with things like that in considerable length. For instance, one of the successor trumpeters in the orchestra, Clark Terry, put all of that together with a speed and virtuosity that was simply beyond belief. All the half-valving, all the plunger techniques you could ask for, all in one player, in one solo. It was phenomenal. And it never was not musical. It was never for its own sake. We'll pass beyond that. And I couldn't resist putting this in. This is a technique that is not unheard of or unknown in many kinds of music, but this man does it so perfectly here. This, by the way, is the way the gliss that opens the Rhapsody in Blue ought to sound, but no one can make it sound this way. And while you listen to the clarinet, listen to everything in all the polyphonic things going on behind him here. Wasn't. You take it into the nose, but that is so perfectly controlled, it's just unbelievable. Thank God for recordings when you hear something like that. Well, all this music, but that's one. All right, I love Andre Previn's words on Ellington, in spite of what I may think about Andre Previn as a musician. Any Hollywood composer can stand in front of 1,000 fiddles and 1,000 brass and make a dramatic gesture, and every studio composer in the house can nod his head and say, oh yes, well this is how that's done. He can tell you what's on the paper in front of every musician up there. And Ellington sits at the piano, lowers one finger, three guys play something, and I couldn't tell you what it is. Now, my examples, again, are going to be conservative. In terms of Ellington's total output and growth, but this moment from the blues piece called Subtle Lament, these inversions are the point, and Although my friend Gunther Schuller denies it, I insist that one of these tenor saxophones is being doubled by a plunger trombone, very subtly, with the mute held tight and then opened at very last note. The reason my subject is particularly appropriate to this organization is that, you know, whatever exists in the warehouse where Ellington's parts, music, that is to say musical parts, are stored, we don't know, and we can't get the family to let us in, and we can't get the heirs to go into this. I mean, this is a major musical problem for scholarship and performance. So what we do is we try to take this stuff off of records, and you can imagine how difficult it is on the basis of what you've just heard, I'm sure. What is going on there? What is that, and who's playing it? And as I say, we have a lot of disagreements among ourselves about that. I just indicated one. This next one is from another blues piece of the next year. This is Blue Light, and this is a piece played by three horns and rhythm, the three you see there, clarinet, muted trombone, and muted trumpet, and this uses what we call the mood indigo effect. Mood indigo, again, is appropriate to recordings, by the way, because I didn't know this until recently, but he originally wrote it because in the electrical recording of 1930, I think is the date, or 31, there was a hum in the microphone at the Victor studio. So he wrote this passage in mood indigo, not this piece, but mood indigo, around that hum. That was his purpose, to incorporate the electronic deficiency into the piece of music. And he produced one of his great works. And also, he produced an effect which he came back to again and again and again, that is voicing for this, you know, it's quite a stroke to put that clarinet in the lower register and give the lead to the either the trumpet or the trombone, depending on which piece we're talking about, of the successions. But this is the one called Blue Light, again in blues form. And I'm very proud of myself, by the way. I'll be subjective and egotistical. I had this record when I was 16 years old, and I had some idea of what the heck I had, too. I had a lot of junk at that age, but I had this. By the way, those are two examples of something that Ellington did in the late 30s and the early 40s again and again. His written thematic statements in these pieces, the two you've just heard, for instance, and in several others, are very simple and only mood setting and texture setting. The melodic thrust in those pieces is up to the improvisers, and they carried it beautifully. In fact, the trombone solo by Lawrence Brown on Blue Light was such an exceptional melody that Ellington later reused it in a piece called Translucency, and there it became the main theme. Okay, now I have to keep moving. I could go on with that kind of thing for many hours, and much more challengingly, actually. But let's move to the question of rhythm. I'll be frank with you in front about this one. I do not think that I would be willing to award Ellington any great originality rhythmically, which may be odd to some of you in a music like jazz, but I don't think so. But I think the way that he used the various, the commonplace rhythmic language of any period of jazz, he absorbed it quickly, and he was able to use it very effectively and very personally, but not truly originally. And that's a small or a large distinction, I guess, depending on how you look at it. This comparison will show you what I mean. These are two big band blues pieces, one terribly familiar, the out riffs, as we call them, from Count Basie's 1 o'clock Jump, which were originally just ad-lib stuff on the bandstand, by the way, and then got written down and played every night, and still are, except I now learn that Basie does not play anymore. We might hold a moment of silence for that. He's in the hospital and probably will not play, which means the band won't play, and that, to me, is a loss of one of the great ensembles. Well, anyway, if you compare that in the way the accents fall in 1 o'clock Jump, the way that, you know, the melodic rhythm of that with this Ellington big band blues called Main Stem, I think you'll see what I mean. The general rhythmic coinage here is the same, and yet no one but Ellington would have placed these accents the way they're done in Main Stem. Blue. And the other one, yeah.
The blue.
Did I forget that? Put those two blues chords on paper, somebody. Go ahead. Well, here's a kind of thing that you find in Ellington over and over again. This is maybe the most succinct example of it, and the real point here is not that this is a particularly original thing for anybody to do, this Hockett passage from Bragging and Brass, but think of this, you know, in the context. Here's a man leading what is passing for a dance band, who is playing music night after night that passes for dance music. Now, I should say, as a part of that, the thing that really made Ellington discover and pursue the real nature of his talent as a composer was when he got a job in that notorious and long-remembered place called the Cotton Club. Because the job there was not so much to play for social dancing, for the people who came to the club. He also had to provide theater music of all kinds for the little miniature reviews that were a part of the show. And he had to write overtures, he had to write fill, he had to write accompaniment for various kinds of dancing, chorus dancing, specialty dances. He had to write pieces that were attractive to the audience simply to sit and listen to with nothing going on but the music and so forth. And probably this was one of them, or in any case, if it wasn't that kind of piece, it's a kind of undertake. But again, how many people working in the context of seeming to lead a dance band for, you know, competing with everybody else's dance band, would have even undertaken a challenge like this? And why indeed? Measures of that, by the way. Now, listen, by the way, for all of you feline fans, the chord progression under that is the tiger rag. He used it a lot in his early days. In fact, he used it more than he used the blues, which is really the last great tiger rag piece by Ellington is called The Flaming Sword. It's quite a piece. Well, okay. Now, I have to include this juxtaposition of instruments from the score he wrote for that James Stewart movie called Anatomy of a Murder, and the title he put on this passage is Midnight Indigo. I'll tell you right now, I think that the score for Anatomy of a Murder is a terrible film score, just terrible, because, and this may be my bias, but my reason is that it is impossible for me to pay any attention to what poor Jimmy Stewart is going through, because that music is so strong and so assertive that, forget it, you know. And that's not what film writing should be. Now, let me play you a couple of early pieces, very early, in terms of his budding maturity. These come from the same period as the original Mood Indigo. The second one, I know that some of you have heard because I played it at one of these meetings before for another reason. I've abbreviated the mystery song because the most challenging part of the mystery song is the opening 32 measures. And this has one of the most uncanny musical sounds I think any American's been responsible for. We still do, us Ellington freaks still don't know what's going on here or how he achieved it. I have my own theory that it uses those mutes that have now passed out of use, and I'm sorry about it, the soft felt mute. It's a piece of circular felt with a little cut in the edge. You just hang it over the bell of the horn. But which horns it's hung over, I don't know. This is a passage from Ellington that thrilled Constant Lambert in Ellington's first visit to Europe, by the way. But then Constant Lambert was trying to get Schoenberg, you see. That was his real game in praising Ellington. He was trying to get the atonalist, so I discount most of what he said about Duke. In fact, he didn't say much, except he liked him, and he said it at great length and with a lot of adjectives and adverbs, but there's not much substance to it if you look at it. The other one is Old Man Blues. Now, Old Man Blues is not a blues in the sense that it's a 12-measure form. It's a takeoff on Old Man River, which is why the title, but it is a remarkable piece of writing. Remember, when you hear this, there are only 12 musicians here, including the pianist, who is not always playing. Apropos what I was saying earlier about performing this music, I'll tell you that this past weekend in Richmond, Virginia, I heard a student band of 18 and 20-year-olds play that piece, perfectly notated off record by the man who teaches there, Doug Richards. And they played it so well that if I closed my eyes, I thought I was hearing that period of Ellington live. It was just about as nearly perfect as anything of that kind I've ever heard. It can be done with the right people doing it, and a man like Doug Richards. God bless him. Well, I'm not saying very much about the later works in the suites, except that they are an enormous challenge, which even us Ellingtonians have not met in any way. I got reacquainted with one only 2 weeks ago called the Far East Suite, and there were two pieces in that that just floored me, and I had never paid enough attention to them before. Well, okay, that's me, but it's typical of us because there's such an enormous body of music here, and inevitably an uneven body of music. The demands of playing every night were met, you know, and constantly coming up with new material. Every time you change the record companies, you got to redo your repertory one way or another, and he wasn't content just to revisit the old things, although, as we'll see, he did that. But from Sweet Thursday, this is a pun after that Steinbeck book. I must say I admire this suite much more than that book, but in any case, what he did here was write a four-part suite, all in blues forms in various keys, and all out of the two-note motive, which introduces this thing. And what I've done here is just string together taped excerpts that show some of the uses of that motive, and I'm not saying that I've exhausted it, throughout the suite. The second one you'll hear is here because the two tones get flattened out to one and syncopated, but it is still the same motive, I'm sure. And then the final one, I'll call your attention to that, because when that comes up, it's played on pizzicato violin by Ray Nance, and it ends the final movement of the suite, and it is like a search for that those two notes. It's, where are they? Where are they? Where are they? And finally, there they are. It's a wonderfully witty, lightweight way to end this thing.
Thank you. I must tell you that the one thing about him I think that I admire the most is based on an assumption which I realize I've been carrying all my life and never really articulated until fairly recently, and I could put it this way. I think that however well we carry and continue European pursuits in the arts and carry on European genres of art, both as performers and as composers in music, or as writers in literature and as dramatists and all the rest, I think it is true that a truly new country needs a new culture. And Ellington, like Fred Astaire, like D.W. Griffith, like John Ford, is one of the people, like Dashiell Hammett, is one of the people who has helped create that truly new culture. After all, the countries of Central Europe, whatever they learned from the accomplishments of others, did not imitate. And sometimes I think that when we pursue those European paths strictly, we simply imitate. Ellington was not an imitator. And although he has written many pompous introductions to pieces, like anybody else, like Rossini, and a few pompous endings, he was basically very unpretentious about what he was doing. He was having a wonderful time writing music for musicians who would play it back to him immediately. All right, now I have to end with this revisit to Mood Indigo, which was recorded in 1950. I made a slight edit in it because there is a vocal chorus, which sometimes he included vocal on the two sections, the two different sections of Mood Indigo. And he sometimes did it, and he did it in this recorded performance, but he didn't always, so I've omitted it here. That's my standard for doing that, is his own practice on the bandstand.
Thank you.
Get through this without Peter speaking to me after all. Thank you very much.